Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbell. On this episode, we continue to share flying stories from the staff and senior fellows at the Mitchell Institute. If you are a regular listener, we hope to share some of our tactical expertise to better inform the audience of the background and experience of the team. If you're new to the Aerospace Advantage podcast, thank you so much for taking the time to get to know us. Surely these stories will give you new insight to the folks that are impacting our nation's space and air power challenges. So without further ado, it is my pleasure to introduce General Kevin Chili Chilton to the episode.
Thanks, Slick. It's really great to be able to participate with you today and with these other two gentlemen who I know you're about to introduce, who are well known to all, I'm sure.
Well, sir, and we are so fired up to have you on the team, and I can't wait to get to your story as well. Just continuing on, we've got Major General Larry Stutzream. So, Stutz, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's always good to be with you, Slick, and I really appreciate being together with these compadres.
Absolutely. We're going to have a ball. And, of course, last but certainly not least, Colonel Mark Gonzo Gunzinger is back to talk about flying the mighty Buff.
Hey, happy holidays, Slick.
Happy holidays to you, Mark. So, and for all of us, you know, it's really been a fun trip down memory lane as we talk about the flying stories. And we're doing that to mix the flow up. And I really want to get started with Gonzo talking about some of his time flying the B-52. And, you know, it's easy for us fighter guys to kind of go back and forth and kick it around, you know, with the single seat mentality. But Gonzo, if you don't mind bringing that perspective of a crew, and I know the audience will really appreciate a quick breakdown on what the crew of the B-52 is made up of and what their roles and responsibilities are. So I really appreciate it if you wouldn't mind give us that quick rundown.
Yeah, it's always good to tell a heavy story before we get to the light aircraft. So crew is six. They're now down to five because crew used to include a gunner, and they'd remove the guns from the B-52. So you had a pilot and a co-pilot. They had a radar navigator. Primary job was to back up, navigate, and then do the actual bomb runs and release weapons on targets. The navigator who backed up the radar navigator, and then electronic warfare officer, and finally the gunner I mentioned, who also had a secondary duty of making cookies on long flights in the little oven we had in that aircraft.
Nice.
Did they take that gun away from you guys for a reason?
Yeah, I think that was actually the case. You could actually get a little extra thrust out of that.
Well, awesome. No, I appreciate the breakdown. I know the audience will definitely appreciate understanding who you're coordinating with on the airplane. So with that, Gonzo, you got to give it to us. Let's hear the flying story. So there I was.
Okay, so this goes back to 1982, Operation Bright Star, which was an exercise of the Strategic Projection Force, been founded a couple years earlier by President Carter. So on the morning of 23 November 1981, I flew a sortie as part of a six-ship of B-52s. It turned out to be the longest nonstop bombing mission in the history of the Strategic Air Command. There are two flights of bombers, three out of Minot Air Force Base and three out of Grand Forks, and we joined up and we flew as a six-ship over to Egypt and then back, a little over 15,000 miles, just to demonstrate to the Soviets and others how bombers could project power globally. So just some numbers, 15,000 miles, 32.2 hours. We were the last of the six to land, so we flew the longest, seven area refuelings. So what we did was we flew across the Atlantic through the Med and into Egypt, and we dropped down to 600 feet, and we did a low level all the way down to the South Egypt and back as a six ship. Low level, it's 600 feet. We hit our initial point for a bomb run on a runway that was located just northwest of Cairo West. And we hit it within 10 seconds of our required timing. And then we each released about 27 Mark 82 Snake Eye 500-pound bombs on a runway they built just to do this little demonstration for Egypt and the Soviets who are watching from some stands about a mile or two away. And there's about a minute separation between each bomber's release of weapons. After climb out, we headed west across the Med, and this is where it started to get fun. Now, our flight plan took us just to the north of Muammar Gaddafi's so-called proclaimed line of death across the Gulf of Sidra. Now, he had known that we were going to fly this demonstration. He had threatened that if bombers come anywhere near the Gulf of Sidra, I'm going to shoot them down. So we climbed out, leveled off, we're getting ready for our next refueling. We got a call from the AWACS saying, hey, Libya just launched on you guys. Go hot guns. And we were, okay, this will be fun. And we got a call about 10 minutes later, and they said, okay. We took care of it. We found out after we landed that Egyptian Air Force controller on board the AWACS said, call my people. Called his people, and they launched on the Libyan fighters and took care of that problem. So we proceeded back across the Atlantic, and it next gets interesting in the landing. We had to shut an engine down over the Western Med because we lost oil on the return, and then we were going to be number three to land at Minot. Now, this was, like I said, middle of winter and cold. So the runway had about decent visibility. It was still above minimums, and the first two aircraft landed successfully. The problem was it was so cold that their engines created ice fog. So we shot one approach and had to go missed approach. We shot a second one. We said, well, if we can't make this one, we're going to have to go elsewhere. And I was, as the co-pilot at the time, I was outside the window watching for the runway, and the pilot was actually flying the instrument approach. We broke out about 300 feet above the ground. I said, I've got the runway, go visual. He went visual. He said, I've got it. And then he went full left yoke. And we were probably about 150 feet above the ground at that time. If you know we've got a long wingspan in the B-52, that's not a good thing. So I grabbed the yoke, went full back, full right, and tried to push the throttles through the nose of the aircraft and popped the aircraft up, and we climbed out. We went right over the top of our wives and the wing commander and the vice wing commander who were standing on the hammerhead. All they saw was this big white chunk of metal go right over their heads. So we climbed out, and that's when it started to get really interesting. Now, I had already shut down engine 5, but then we had to shut down another engine because it also was low on fuel below mins. And then we discovered that we had 7,000 pounds of fuel in one of our mains that was trapped, and we couldn't pump it out. And SAC couldn't launch another tanker because of weather. It was below mins, no one could launch. They couldn't get to us in time. And then one of our main rudder hydraulic fuel systems failed. You know, when things go bad, they go worse.
Bad.
That's
bad.
What happened. Mm-hmm. So we were trying to see if we get into Grand Forks to land because Minot was now closed. Ice fog, thank you. But Grand Forks was close, and we didn't have enough fuel to make another airfield. So we were talking about departing the aircraft in a rather rapid manner using our ejection seats, and we got a call and said, sucker hole opened up over Grand Forks. Come now. Boom. So we got over there, penetrated, and landed. They just barely had mins. We successfully landed, and the wing commander met us on the runway and said, stop engines, get out of that aircraft. Because he didn't want us to taxi on this runway. So that was our 32.2-hour sortie, and it was quite an experience.
There's something to be said about at the end of 30 hours or so is when all this is happening at the home drone. I mean, you must have been exhausted.
We were exhausted, but we were also thirsty. We took 2 cases of Coke, 2 cans of water, 2 cans of coffee, and we had just about 2 or 3 cups of water left by the time we landed.
And you still have to stay focused.
Yeah.
That sounds like running out of coffee is worse than running out of fuel in those circumstances.
Oh, that was bad. Trying to stay awake and concentrate and be sharp and fix broken airplanes and weather and so forth with no coffee.
You know, I think for me, because it was about 8 hours before you went to the low-level piece.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, that's heroic. Go over and, go down low and root around and then come back. 7 or so.
Well, I've got a great picture at home. I was, again, in the co-pilot seat, and we flew right over Giza, the pyramids, and we banked a little bit so we could take some really great shots at the pyramids. We were about 800 feet at that time.
And those buffs were already pretty old by that time, right?
Yeah, indeed. I think the newest buff, and it was our H models, were delivered in 1963.
Yeah.
It's a great airplane. I really enjoyed when I was 8th Air Force Commander checking out the B-52. You know, I could have checked out in multiple different airplanes, I guess, but it was right there at Barksdale, iconic airplane. I really enjoyed qualifying in the airplane. I wasn't mission ready, but you know, I flew it and tried to fly it whenever I could. And you asked about crew concept, you know, that it is a crewed airplane. I started in the RF-4, which is a crewed airplane.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had a lot of single seat time as well, but it's different. And when you got a crew that's working well together, it's unbelievable, you know, what the magic you can create. So I can only imagine the crew you guys had put together for that mission was a pretty special group.
Yeah, we are a stand-of-our crew, and they really clicked and made that mission work. Just right at the end, we were just pretty fried. Made a couple mistakes there, but fly the jet first, always, and get on the ground safely. Always.
Well, I got to pull your chain a little bit, Gonzo. Please, I think that's part of this, isn't it, Stutz? That, yep. You know, you can't get away with telling a story without a follow-on. When I was checking out, it was my check ride in the B-52, in fact. And, you know, my wife is the daughter of a fighter pilot. And Kathy's a flight test engineer. She did a lot of her flight tests in the backseat of F-16s, T-38s. She, you know, flew all that stuff in test pilot school, too. So she kind of had this, you know, single seat, single engine mentality. I had to convince her that the Eagle was truly better than the F-16. And I'm not sure she ever completely bought it.
I don't know about that. You can talk about that.
Anyway, she was very good at keeping me grounded. And I remember the day of my check ride, there was a problem on the throttle quadrant on the B-52, and touched down, you know, pulled an idle, and we're doing touch and goes. And when he pulled it back to the idle stop, one of the stops was broken, and the throttle actually went over and went to cutoff. And I didn't notice it. I mean, I could hardly count to five, let alone eight. And neither did the IP. And so I pushed the engines up to go around, and only seven come up, you know, because the other one shut down. So we continued to take off, come around. I said, yeah. So I'm telling Kathy the story afterwards. I said, yeah, we lost an engine on a touch and go. And I came around and, you know, we declared emergency engine failure and full stop, passed the check ride. And she said, oh, no. You mean you had to go through the dreaded seven engine approach? This is my F-16 wife. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I said, yeah, shut up.
I lost the single engine in the F-16 once. And let me tell you, you know you've lost the engine. Yeah. There's no doubt
about
it.
It's quiet.
It's very quiet.
Yeah, you can actually, the truth of the matter is, at altitude cruising speeds, if you shut an engine down, you save fuel without any performance loss. It's amazing.
In the B-52.
In the B-52,
yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. Not so on an F-16. So
that's perhaps not.
No, yeah. Not whatsoever. I did try to air refuel. I had one sortie in the B-52, and they wanted me to just maintain, you know, the position. We didn't refuel, but I had a hard time. I really had a hard time.
Oh,
over controlling, yeah. Getting into PIOs and stuff, and it was a challenge.
Yeah, he just set the power, and then he just used the two center engines, you know, to tweak a little bit back and forth.
I like the single engine simplicity, actually. I like that.
Well, hey, I want to flow over to Stutz, if you don't mind. And because Stutz, you know what you're talking about. You've flown, you know, a few different airplanes in your career. And honestly, it's one of the things that's really changed in the Air Force. You know, nowadays it's really rare to hear of somebody that's flown multiple weapon systems. So quickly bring us up to speed on what you officially flew in the Air Force, Stutz.
Okay. So I started out in the F-4. Flew the D model and the E model, and I've got about one third of my flying career in three airplanes. So I flew the F-4, and I then transitioned to the F-16, and this is the early F-16 A model. And I tell you, my first sortie in the F-16 was fantastic. It was everything I ever wanted in a fighter. The visibility, the power, strap it on, everything was just, it was wonderful. Later, I flew the A-10. So, of course, that's all about blowing stuff up, and it's the big old gun, 30-millimeter gun, and wow, you can do some damage with that thing. But I'll tell you, Slick, what I really hearken back to is the F-4, because the IPs and the commanders I was in the Philippines, my first assignment, and they all came out of Vietnam, and they stayed in the Pacific, and they were very changed in terms of wingman discipline, the disciplines of flying, and, you know, fly and fight, don't you forget it. So my grounding in the fighter was really shaped by these gents that came out of the war. So that's my background, Slick.
Well, no, and I really appreciate that. I'm sure the audience does as well, because you're a lucky man, and you know, most folks would kill just to have flown one of these airplanes, and to split your career in thirds with three, you know, iconic airplanes is pretty incredible. So I know it's going to be hard for you to pick one, but I'd love to hear your "There I Was" flying story.
Okay, well, I'm going to take us back to the Cold War and my first assignment in the F-4 at Clark Air Base in the Philippines. And, you know, this was the height of the Cold War. And if you remember, that doomsday clock was about 2 minutes from midnight up there at the University of Chicago. You know, the Russians or the Soviets at that time in the United States were all, you know, lots of secrets, and we were trying to figure out what each other was doing. And so one lazy, early Sunday morning, I got a call from my flight commander, and he says, "Stutz, get your flight suit on, come in. Don't talk to anybody, don't tell your wife. Something's going on, we need you in." So I race to the squadron, and there's a small group of folks there. We go into a briefing room. Intel officer comes in, has his satchel, you know, opens it up, takes this inside satchel out, pulls out this folder, and it's got a top secret document on it, cover document. And we have this following situation. We have the Novorossiysk. It's a new aircraft carrier that the Russians were steaming north of the Philippines. And the Novorossiysk was known to have some curious things on the deck. And, you know, the F-4 there, we had just transitioned to a system called Paved TAC, which was one of the early generation sensors. It had IR and it had video you could record, but it was massive. It was bigger than a centerline fuel tank on an F-4, and it was safety wired. If you lost an engine, you're going to bail out because you couldn't get rid of the pod. So we had just gotten checked out, and this mission was to, with no radios, just take a single aircraft and go up, find this aircraft carrier. And we had this rule set that came back to us from up on high, and that was we couldn't do anything provocative, because these were the Russians. Remember, you know, I mean, we're minutes away from a nuclear, you know, World War III. So the rule set was, first of all, no ordnance. They pinned our guns, so we couldn't even fire the guns, so we were unarmed. We are going to be at 2,500 feet, 350 knots over the aircraft carrier. Racetrack, it was defined, the size, and inside the racetrack could be the carrier. So we'd go around, and while my back seater, the weapon system officer, the WISO, would be, you know, heads down, recording, looking, searching for what he could find on the deck. So we get out there, and we're set up in our racetrack over the Novorossiysk. And this is cool, because back then you didn't encounter face-to-face the Soviets. They were 10 feet tall, and they're always secret guys, you know, doing stuff. So I'm just flying the airplane, and this is a boring mission for me, exciting to see what was going on, but the WISO's doing all the work back there. So we're going down kind of the straightaway of the racetrack, and I'm looking down at the Novorossiysk, and I can see these aircraft starting to come off the carrier. They were Yak-38s. It was the Russian or the Soviet Forager vertical takeoff aircraft, and two of them come off the deck, and it's close. I mean, we're only at 2,500 feet above them, and so these guys kind of disappear behind us, and I look back. And at about my 8 o'clock position, I see one of these guys who looks like he's rejoining on us, about 8 o'clock position. Well, we're going straight, and we come to the turn point. WISO calls the, you know, 45 degrees of bank, turn 350 knots, level flight, no big deal. But as soon as I start turning, the Forager suddenly is way ahead of the line on this rejoin. And so he's got a lot of smash compared to us, a lot of velocity overtake. And he's pulling out. You can see classic rejoin on an aircraft. But now we get this little wing dip thing left and right. You know, you kind of know when somebody's rejoining, like, can this guy see you? Suddenly I realize that He's out there maybe about 4,000 or 5,000 feet now, but he's belly up to me, and he's just staying right on my canopy, and we're on a collision course. And I am sure this guy does not see me. Does not. So I go, tighten up my turn a little bit. He's up and down, but now I can really see him starting to close on us very quickly. About a couple hundred feet out, I've got to do something and violate all the rules. And I see on his belly, he's got two aphids. He's loaded. He's got two heat-seeking missiles, and he's coming, and he's going to hit me. So at the last minute, I have to push over. I slice down toward the carrier, and he does this huge, you know, climbing maneuver and then a slice almost to a split S, which I was a little worried whether he's going to make it through the bottom of that, and he's kind of barrel rolls it out. And that was it. He was gone. Never came back. So we finish up about 10 minutes, and we fly back to the Philippines Lana Clark Air Base. So we hit the ground, and at the end of the runway, there's a car with my ops officer in it. That's never a good sign, by the way, because no one ever is there at the end of the runway to greet you unless something's gone wrong. So he follows us back in. We get into the chocks, and he's got my flight commander with him. By the way, the flight commander told me before we took off, great guy, he's passed now, and he's just a wonderful guy. And as we were stepping in the airplane, Jim says to me, he goes, okay, he's laughing at you guys. Now, you guys don't start World War III. Big joke. As soon as I get out of the plane, my flight commander comes up to me and goes, what are you guys trying to do, start World War III? And, you know, we don't know what's going on. We don't understand this. Well, next trip is direct to the wing commander's office. He's looks a little disheveled because they just had to get him out of bed. About an hour later, we go up to the numbered Air Force commander there at Clark and stood in front of his desk after being told don't say anything. And we were grounded, and we had no idea what was going on, except for there was an allegation that we were dogfighting with these Yak-38s over the Novorossiysk. So we're grounded for about a week, and then, you know, okay, Stutz, you and your Wizzo, you're back on the flying schedule. Everything's cool. And all that we knew was that there was a report that went up from the Navy ship. They used to shadow the Russian ships with a Navy ship. And an op rep went to PACOM, straight up National Command Center. Everybody knew, and it had reported that we had been dogfighting with these Soviets over the carrier. Dogfighting. F-4 with a paved tac pod. That's ridiculous. So we never got much fidelity on. A year and a half later, I'm at my next assignment at PACAF, Pacific Air Forces. And I'm in the first staff meeting. This intel officer comes up to me and goes, hey, were you on that flight that was dogfighting with the Soviets and almost started World War III? And I said, yeah, that was me. He said, you know, that got all messed up. He said, the Navy guys were really excited that you stood up to the Soviets and that you didn't let them push you around. And they sent up an op rep to cheer you guys on and compliment the Air Force guys that were making us look so good out there. And I thought to myself, the lesson is a fighter pilot can be a hero one day, but not really acknowledged for it. And you can also be a skunk one day and be a hero the next. I mean, it's just, so that's my story from the Cold War and the old F-4 days.
I love it. That's a great story.
And I'm the guy, or just remember this, I'm the guy that almost, you know, started the nuclear winter, the World War III, and
that'd be a heck of a line on your resume. I'm the guy that started World War III. You've done good.
I would love to hear the story from the Yak pilot's point of view. I wonder if that, I mean, post-Cold War, there was a lot of transparency. Yeah. How that story was told from their perspective.
That's interesting.
If he came back and got a hero of the Soviet Union award while you're standing at attention, you know, eating from the mantle for a week.
Well. I tell you, it
probably was F-4. What F-4? I never saw an F-4.
Well, you know, we thought that, like I said before, we always thought the Soviets were just so colossal. And, you know, things like this, you start to wonder, you know.
Yeah.
And, of course, later we found out the Yak-38 was not a, you know, it's kind of very similar in looks to the Marine Harrier. But the Harrier was superior to that airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Still, it had hot ordnance. I had nothing. Nothing.
Just your charm.
Just.
Oh, that's great. Well, you know, normally we would go in rank order on these things, especially with the first time having General Chilton here with us. But we had to save you for last, sir, because not only did General Chilton fly two fighter jets in the Air Force, the F-4 and the F-15, but he also flew the space shuttle, and not only once, but three times. So, sir, I know the F-4 and the F-15 are awesome, but I know our audience would absolutely love to hear anything you could share with us about what it was like to fly the space shuttle. So do you mind to share some of that experience with us?
I'd be happy to do that. But and I did have the opportunity to fly just about every model of the F-4 except the G model in the U.S. inventory as a test pilot. But I actually started in the RF-4. And so I was originally a reconnaissance F-4 pilot, which I loved. I loved going, you know, when they pay you to go low and fast.
Yeah.
That was just every day. That was really, really a lot of fun. And first assignment was to Okinawa. Of course, you can't do a lot of low-level training on an island. So we kept 25% of the squadron on detachment up in Korea. And so it was 2 weeks in Korea, 6 weeks home was a normal rotation. And that's where you really, you know, learned how to fly low-level was in South Korea around the peninsula there, which was great fun. But space shuttle story. So I'll tell you a story about my first flight, and I have to back up a little bit. It was in our training as a class, as a new class at NASA, where we'd be trained by engineers and scientists, and then also by people who had flown in space. And one of the astronauts at the Johnson Space Center, a guy named Pinky Nelson, was a great astronaut. He had flown the manned maneuvering unit, not the first time it was flown. Bruce McCandless flew that, but Pinky flew it on the first operational employment of it to grab a satellite and bring it into the shuttle cargo bay for repair. And Pinky's advice to us, you know, a lot of this was wisdom that he was sharing. He says, look, when you go on your first space shuttle flight, so you're going to train like crazy to, you know, follow all the procedures and hit the timelines and the checklists and everything else. He says, but there's something else you need to do. You need to train yourself to enjoy the moment while you're up there. So, you know, I mean, you don't want to come back after a perfectly flown flight and have someone say, well, what does the Earth look like from space and be able, and not be able, and say, well, I don't know. I never looked out the window. I was too busy, you know. So he said he intentionally did this on this particular, on his flight, as he was approaching the satellite in the simulator. You know, there's coasting periods. He would, you know, train himself to look left and right and then back at the satellite so he could look down at the Earth and then look out into space. It just kind of planted that seed in my head. So that's a good idea. I'm going to think about something I want to train myself to do so I can appreciate something on my first flight. Well, I roll the clock forward several years, and I'm in that situation. I'm the only rookie on Flight 49, STS-49, on the maiden voyage of Endeavor. I mean, talk about I was so blessed. I mean, flying a brand new spaceship on its first flight, and the only rookies on the flight was Endeavor and me. And I promise you, Endeavor smelled like a new car inside. I mean, it was just, and outside she was so beautiful. She hadn't been through reentry yet, so I mean, she just shined, and it was just great. So you know, long before that, we're in the simulator training. I'm thinking, well, what is it on launch that I'd kind of like to see? So well, you know, I'm on the right seat, and the launch gantry is out across the cockpit, out the commander seat. And part of my rhythm right prior to liftoff, there's several things we had to do. One was at T-minus 6 seconds, the main engines would ignite. And right by my left knee were three tape gauges that showed percent output of the engine. So sitting at zero, and they'd throttle up. And when they hit 100% at about 3 seconds before launch, my call was 3 to 100. That's what the pilot would say. And then, so I'm scanning from there. Then at liftoff, the next scan for me is, again, to my left, is to look at the CRTs for the software, because we actually change software right at liftoff. You go into a different mode.
Yeah.
And so you'd look there and make a call that you're in the correct software mode. And then since I'm scanning, you know, right to left, I thought I'm going to continue to scan and look out the commander's window, because I want to see the gantry fall away. I wanted to get a sense of the speed that we were going up the gantry. And in the simulator, I practice this every time. You know, it's just a right to left scan and then back in on my gauges. Well, in the simulator, it's a green CRT window you're looking at and a stick figure of the gantry. But, you know, this is going to be cool. So we get to launch day. And, you know, you ask people who've flown in space, what's launch like? I mean, that's really a big question that you want to ask. You never think to ask, what's it like 6 seconds prior to launch when the main engine's light? And the simulator does not simulate this very well. So, you know, the guy's counting backwards from 10. He gets to 6, go for, you know, 8, go for main engine start, 6 seconds. I look down at the tapes, and the vehicle starts shaking so much that I cannot read the tapes. Man, I can see them coming up. I can't see the numbers. And my head's kind of, you know, banging off the inside of the helmet. And I have this experience that, you know, they talk about people in an automobile accident, time dilation, where everything just seems to slow down.
Yeah.
And for me, those 6 seconds felt like 6 minutes. And it felt like, and what I'm thinking, you know, my brain is operating at high speeds going, if we don't lift off, something's coming off this vehicle. I can't believe the vibrations. I mean, the tail's going to shake off. Something's going to shake off. And now it's time for me to make the call. And I realize I can't read the gauges. And I'm thinking, I've trained for a year and a half to read these gauges. So what would any good fighter pilot do at this moment? 3 out of 100. And I thought this through as I was saying it. I said, you know, if I'm wrong, no one's going to know. And if I'm right, you know, everybody's going to be happy. So, bam, now we lift off, and now it really starts to shake, but a different kind of shake. You're pushed back in the seat, you know, 3 Gs, which, you know, that's not a big deal if you're taking it head to toe like you do in a fighter. 3G turns easy. And it's not even that debilitating when you're taking it through the chest as we are at liftoff, but it's still significant. I mean, it's an acceleration like you've never felt before in that direction, no matter what kind of jet you've flown. Or Formula One car, even, you know, it's a good kick. So I continue my scan to the left, look at the green screens, and make the call for the software change, and then I look out the window. Now, here's the other thing: the simulator didn't simulate very well at the Johnson Space Center, and that was at T minus 6 seconds when the main engine's light. They also, just before that, they flood the launch pad with water, a big, huge deluge, and it's to suppress the sound. The acoustic vibration that you get off the reflection of the main engines that can really do damage to the vehicle. And that flashes to steam instantly during that 6 seconds. And if you look at old videos of the space shuttle taking off, you know, you'll see this big cloud, and then out of the cloud comes the shuttle. You really never see it come off the pad from the distance. You see it when it lifts up through the cloud. Well, that cloud of steam is going up, right, pretty fast. And by the time I've scanned over to the left, that cloud of steam is going up past the window still. And the immediate sensation for me is that, just like if we've all experienced this, we're at a stoplight and you're not really looking out the window and the guy next to you moves forward a little bit and you think I'm sliding backwards and you step on the brake. I thought we were falling back into the flame trench. That's what my eyes are telling me. Yeah. I'm pinned back by 3 Gs, which tells me I'm going up, right? But you know how powerful your vision is to your sense of where you are, what you're doing, which is why vertigo is a problem flying airplanes. I'll tell you what, I have never looked back at the instruments that fast. I mean, my head snapped back in the cockpit, and I looked immediately at the acceleration gauge. And we were at, you know, 90 feet per second squared, which means, you know, we're at about 3 Gs and we're going up. And then I said, okay, I'm not looking out the window again until the engine's quiet. Stop. Bad idea. Yeah. So, I mean, these are all classic rookie mistakes, maybe a little unique because of what I wanted to look at, but I just laughed at myself. I think the next time when I looked out the window was when we went through 50 miles and one of my crewmates said, "Welcome to space, Chili." And I pulled myself up out of my seat a little bit to look out the window and get a view for the first time, get that first look, which was great.
You know, it's interesting. You made that call, though you couldn't read the gauge. But I wonder if you had not made that call, if it disrupts the team, you know, the crew play that's going on at that time.
You get used to certain things. It's a rhythm, just like you say, Stutz. Right. You know, I doubt it. You know, because I mean, bang, next you're off the pad. Yeah. You know, 2 seconds later, and you know, I might have gotten a little debrief on the way back. But the call really wasn't that important because if the engines didn't come up to power, the automatic system was going to abort. I really don't know why we even said it, other than it was a good comm check in the cockpit that pilot and commander can hear each other, and several of the calls were that way. Just right off the pad, All our communications were with Florida until liftoff, until tower clear, in fact. At tower clear, so, you know, a couple hundred feet in the air, you hand it off to the Johnson Space Center. Now they were in control for ascent.
Was that automatic, or did you have to?
You know, they were always listening on the loops, but it was an authority issue, right? You know, who's in control? Because now, once you're off the pad and going, work's done at the Cape. They're heading to party. But, you know, we got 8.5 minutes to go, and if anything fails and you lose an engine or systems failure, that's going to be worked by Mission Control. Houston's going to help you solve that problem, decide whether you're going to abort to Africa, abort back into Kennedy Space Center, do a return to launch site abort or whatever. So right after clearing the pad, also we'd do a roll, and we would roll the vehicle, this is obviously automatic, would roll upside down, because you went to space kind of upside down on your back for aerodynamic reasons, to unload the wing, actually. And you rolled into the plane that you were going up in. So, you know, if you were going due east, you rolled to a due east vector. If you're going up to 57 degrees up the East Coast, you rolled a little more. But anyway, you'd hear this call if you listened to the tapes, you know. You'd hear, roll program, Houston. That was the commander telling Houston that the vehicle had started into the roll.
Right.
And then Houston would say, Roger, roll. That was just to confirm that you could talk to Houston and that they could hear you. That's really the purpose of that. You know, I mean, they could see us. They could see on their data that we were rolling. But it was just a voice check, really, and, you know, a confirmation that everything was hunky-dory at that point.
Do you have a feel for today, how much more is automated in that whole process of launch to orbit?
No, I don't. But, you know, we weren't hand-flying the shuttle to orbit. We trained to do that for a really, really, really low probability, some would say impossible set of failures. You really had you couldn't do it in first stage, so when the solids were burning, just the dynamic pressure loads were so great on the vehicle. It was automatically unloading the loads on the wings and the rudder and stuff. There was the flight controls were moving so fast to, you know, complete a feedback loop on loads and wind shears and stuff. If you tried to hand fly it through that stage, you'd probably break the vehicle and come apart on you. Yeah. But once you came off the solids and you're on just the main engines, you could hand fly it to orbit. You had enough information displayed to you that you could fly it there and get yourself reasonably close. And you're high enough up at that point, less dynamic pressure, and acceleration's gone way down from 3 G's to less than a G when you came off the solids, and then it slowly built back up to 3 G's as you burn down fuel. You know, F equals MA is the mass went down, the force stayed the same, the accelerations went up, and as soon as you hit 3 G's, then the engines would automatically throttle back to not exceed 3 G's, and so you actually would shut down at less than 100% throttle setting because the vehicle is only stressed to like 3.2 G's, your wings would come off. So you could do all that manually post solid rocket motor separation and train for it, but why would you if it's working right? Yeah. And same on reentry. We let the autopilot fly the reentry down until we went subsonic, just below Mach 1, and then we hand flew it in from there. So it had been hand flown back through those regimes by Joe Engel on STS-2 just to validate, so he could do some of that test pilot stuff, wiggle and shake on the way down to validate some of the gains they had set in the flight control system. That, you know, before STS-1, that was just modeled. You know, it had never been done before in a vehicle like that. I mean, that's one of the great things about John Young and Bob Crippen. They're the first Americans to fly in space in a spaceship that had never flown in space before. And so STS-1 was quite the feat. And then Joe Henry commanded the second flight and did a lot of the reentry manually. So we knew we could do it, and we trained to it. But, you know, if that autopilot was working good through those regimes, it was important to let it do its job, because it was going to be so much more precise than we could do.
I love what you said about when you started talking about this, the being in the moment, or being present, you know, taking time, because the three of us, whether it's in an airplane or what you've done, General, which is amazing, there's so little time to really enjoy, look out the window, see how privileged it is to be able to be an Air Force fighter pilot or bomber pilot or be a
any kind of aviator. Yeah, to operate off the surface of the earth and have that freedom to fly. Yeah, I've had those. I'm sure we've all had those moments where flying, just look out the window and you see this incredible sunrise or sunset or thunderhead or something. And you just go, thank you, God, for letting me have the opportunity to take a look at this.
Yeah,
now back to work.
In B-52s, back during the Cold War, we flew 12, 13-hour training sorties, training, of course, to do our nuclear bombing mission over intercontinental ranges. Somewhere in the flight, cruising or going to another low-level refueling, I say, hey, crew, pilot time? Yeah, okay, pilot. And if there's some nice clouds around, we just kind of surf the tops of them and so forth until the EW called and said, pilot, you're making me sick. Autopilot on, sorry.
Yeah, no, those are special opportunities that we were blessed to have.
I think we'd have a little
fun. I think so.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, sir, I can't think of a better way for us to end this this overall discussion. Thanks so much for sharing that with us. Really, really appreciate it.
You bet.
And sir, this podcast has obviously been a lot more informal, which has been really fun, in contrast to what we're normally doing. But I do want to quickly mention, that we will have a podcast coming out very shortly dedicated to you discussing your role here at Mitchell as the Space Power Advantage Research Center chair. In addition to that, I just want to give you an opportunity to just kind of throw a seed out for our listeners and what you think they need to know about the future of space in general.
Well, thanks. I'm so excited to be part of the team here at Mitchell. And you talk about an exciting time to be in the space business. I mean, the paper doesn't come out. I can't imagine how infrequently you get a newspaper done talking about something going on in space, whether it's new satellite constellations going up, new launch vehicles going up. It's just a dynamic time in our nation's history and in history in general around the world. And with the stand-up of the Space Force coming along as well. I can't think of a better time to be involved in this type of work. And I think the work we do here at the Mitchell Institute is important for national security. We want to make sure people are informed about what's going on, but we also want to make sure that the right topics are discussed and debated and thoughtfully considered and contribute to that debate and contribute to at least providing a forum for those debates so that the decisions can be better informed for the future of national security space for the United States of America.
Great to have you here, Chile. Really, really looking forward to working for you.
Thanks, Gonzo. It's going to be fun.
Absolutely. And sir, to your point, it's really great that space has become a household name again, and NASA and all the other companies that are doing what they're doing. So can't say thanks enough for you being here on the podcast, being here at Mitchell, and to Stutz and Gonzo. Thank you guys so much for being here as well.
Hey, thanks, Slick.
Hey, thanks,
My
Slick.
Pleasure.
Thank you, our listeners, for your continued support, and thank you for tuning in to today's show. We've got a lot of new and exciting content coming your way, including some deep dives on space capabilities to kick off the new year. We will also be heading out to air and space events near you, so don't forget to follow or subscribe to the podcast. Also, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn to find out where we will be next year and also to learn about what the Mitchell team has in our sight picture. And please, don't forget to leave us a rating. Hit the like button and follow or subscribe to the Airspace Advantage. You can also leave us a comment to let us know what you think about the show or areas you think we should explore further. And visit us at MitchellAerospacePower.org to get the latest reports, events, and analysis that are charting vectors for our air and space forces. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next time. Stay safe and check six.